Okay, Charlie, do it all over again.
Okay, this is Dan Austin. It is Saturday evening, September 15th, 1990. We're in the Royce Hotel room in New York City near the LaGuardia Airport. And I have some baseball players, scouts, with fantastic memories. The purpose of this tape is for the oral history archives of the National Baseball Hall of Fame. Each gentleman will get a copy of the tape. The master copy will go to the Baseball Hall of Fame unedited in accordance with the instructions given to me. We'll start with Tom Henry. Okay, Tom?
Tom Ferrick.
Ferrick, I'm sorry.
All right. Tom Ferrick, F-E-R-R-I-C-K. Sounds a little bit like Henrik, but I was a pitcher and Tom was an outfielder. I was born January 6, 1950, right here in New York City in the Bronx. And at 21, I signed a contract with the New York Giants to play in their farm system. And the first team I played in their farm system was Greenwood, Mississippi, 1936. From there on, I finally got to the big leagues in 1941 with the Philadelphia Athletics. I developed a sore arm in the Giant organization. They released me in 39, and I went on to pitch semi-pro ball. Went to the big leagues in 41. I was with the A's, Cleveland, 3 years in the Navy, back with the Browns, Washington, Yankees, and Washington. So I spent 12 years in the big leagues as far as pitching. And then I went on to coaching at Indianapolis as a pitching coach. The big league pitching coach situation was Cincinnati 5 years, Philadelphia 1 year, Detroit 4 years as a pitching coach, Kansas City as a pitching coach for a year and a half in 1965 with the Kansas City Athletics. I turned to scouting, and I've been scouting since 1965 with the Oakland Athletics, which Kansas City Athletics left Kansas City to become the Oakland Athletics. And from there, I joined the Royals, and I'm still working part-time for the Kansas City Royals in Kansas City.
Okay. Charlie?
Yeah, Charlie Silvera, S-I-L-V-E-R-A, born in San Francisco, October 13th, 1924. Signed out of San Francisco with the New York Yankees, played 1942 with Wellsville in the Pony League, was a teammate of Jerry Coleman, spent 3 years in World War II, played at Kansas City, Portland, played with the Yankees from 1949 through 1956, 1 year with the Cubs, managed 3 years in the Yankee organization, scouted for Atlanta, scouted for Washington Senators, was a coach with Billy Martin with Detroit, also with Minnesota and Texas. Now, currently a Major League scout with the Milwaukee Brewers out of San Francisco.
Okay. I must say as a side that when I was 10 years old that I saw Charlie play catcher for the Ocean City Blues in the American Association. One terrific league. Cliff?
Cliff Mapes. I started off in the Cleveland organization in 1940, played Class C ball 2 years, and was graduated up to B in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and Wilkes-Barre in 43. In the service a couple of years to come out, and I played another part of the year with Wilkes-Barre, and was drafted that fall by the Yankees, and spent a year in Kansas City at 47, and the next year I had the best year I ever had, and I got called up the next year and stayed with the Yankees from 48 through 51, almost through 51. Got traded off right to last. End up in Browns the rest of that year, and traded to Detroit the next year, 52. And after 52, I went back to Myers, I tore my arm up, and was through.
Where were you born, in what year?
Oh, Southern Nebraska. 1922.
Good Nebraska rancher.
Yeah.
Okay. Allie?
Cornhusker.
The Cornhusker, you bet.
Allie Reynolds. I was, I didn't play baseball until I went to college. And then I signed with the Cleveland Indians for the largest bonus ever given in the Southwest,
$1,000. $1,000.
In 1939. And I went up to Cleveland, and they wanted to send me to Wilkes-Barre, and I told them I didn't have much background, so they sent me to a C League. Springfield, Ohio, in the Mid-Atlantic League. I finished the year there. Not very good. And I went to Cedar Rapids the next year, Class B, and didn't have a very good year there. I had a lot of trouble with sore arms. I played a lot of football. And the next year I went to Wilkes-Barre in the Eastern League, and didn't make the ball club, went back to Cedar Rapids. Next year, which was 42, I went back to Wilkes-Barre and had an exceptional good year. I think I had 11 shutouts, 18 wins, led the league in strikeouts, had earned run average of .77, and I went from there to Cleveland. And I...
This Wilkes-Barre was in the old Eastern League.
Eastern League, yes. And played with Cleveland for 4 years and made all the mistakes every young pitcher makes. I made them twice. And I was traded in 46 during the World Series to the Yankees for Joe Gordon and Eddie Bachman. And I understand that Harris was going to be the manager that year. And he told McPhail he didn't know anything about the pitchers. They got any of the pitchers but Feller. And so Harris said, well, ask Joe DiMaggio. He's sitting right down there. So Joe was the one that suggested my name, thank God.
You beat that. And Eddie Bachman, who came up of the Yankee organization, I think he played third base, if I remember correctly. And then, of course, Joe Gordon played the second base, I think, for the Yankees.
He was an outstanding ball player.
Yeah, great player.
He was a great ball player. He's trading a good ball player for someone that didn't know what he might do.
But Joe DiMaggio made the right assessment.
I must have thrown one behind his head.
He didn't much do that anymore.
Fellas, this is kind of a free-ranging kind of thing, but talking with the people of the Baseball Hall of Fame, you fellas experienced something in the minor leagues that the ball players that have come up in the 70s and 80s will never know, or future ball players. You know, what you experienced is something that will never happen again. Charlie, you started out with a Class D Pony League. What kind of field did you play on up in New York?
In New York, well, it wasn't bad, I guess, for that time, 42. But the thing is, in 42, there weren't any rookie leagues. So you went into a full league that had been playing since April. And there had been people playing that league maybe 3 or 4 years. So they tested you quickly. They might throw a ball up underneath the chin just to find out how this kid, a California hot dog, might survive in this league.
Little chin music.
No, a little chin music in those days. That's right. Even in Class D.
And so how'd they test you other than seeing if you how planted your feet were?
Well, it was just a part of playing every day. And that was just in high school. You could get two or three hits every game, but in professional baseball, you might take the collar 2 or 3 days in a row, and you might say, well, you might want to go home, but that wasn't it. Baseball was the only thing in those days. There wasn't any other professional sport where you could make a living at, so we had to persevere. We had to play baseball.
What was your first contract worth?
$75 a month.
Plus room and board and meals.
Meal money was $1.75 a day. So now, within the next couple of years, probably they'll be making more money on meal money per day than I made my first year in baseball.
That's right.
What'd you get, Tom?
Well, in 1936, the Giants in Greenwood at Farm Club was a Class C league. I got $100 a month, and Charlie might forget, but you had to pay your room and board when you were at home in Greenwood. They only paid your meal money and took care of your lodging when you were on the road.
Was that all the way through the minor leagues?
That's the standard procedure even today. They don't pay for your home when you're at your home field. You pay for your own room and board like you had to get an apartment or a house today.
Uh-huh.
But then meal money in those days, we got $1.25 and we were high in the league. $1.25 a day we went on the road. Mm-hmm. And I got off to a bad start down there. Yeah, I won one. I won my first ball game. It was 4 in a row. And the Giants took the trouble to send a scout down and cut my salary to $85 from $100. So I wasn't a sure shot. And then I gradually got my feet on the ground and had a winning year. And they finally brought me back up to $100. But I can still remember one of the things that happened. I was trying to support my mother. She was a widow. So you couldn't stretch $100 a month very far when you paid your room and board and meal money.
That's right.
But one thing that saved my skin, I can still remember when I was pitching in Greenwood. We had a decent club. The Giants, I think we won the pennant that year. And we went to brash kids from the north playing in Mississippi. We weren't too popular down in the south because, you know, there's a lot of feeling about the North, even at that time, 36.
Still is.
Still is. That's how he rattled, telling the way it is. But near the end of the season, I pitched a game in the playoffs against El Dorado, and I won the ball game, and I got four hits in the ball game. So the woman, the people that I was staying with, renting from for $7 a week, the sheriff's wife and his family, she went through the stands with a cigar box and collected, you know, quarters and dimes and nickels, and I came to about $42. And she presented it to me after the game. I went back to the house, presented it to me, and I sat uptown that night counting that money because that was my car fare home. It cost me $21 to get back home to New York by railroad. So I didn't get that bounty, I wouldn't have made it back home. So that's one of the things I remember about the first year in the minor league, Dan.
And so from one town to another, you got on the bus?
I went to Richmond, I went to Jersey City, and then went out of baseball, went back to semi-pro bowl, and then I signed with the Athletics in 41. So that was my entrance.
You played under Connie Mack then?
Yes. And 1941, I played under Connie Mack, the oldest manager in the game. In 42, I played for Lou Boudreau, the youngest manager.
Mm.
Then I was interrupted by the service before I come back.
That was quite a switch.
Mm. Yeah, but both of those people were excellent people. Connie Mack was a fine human being, and Lou Boudreau was a young player and a young manager, was an excellent baseball man. I really enjoyed playing for him.
I guess something, why did Connie Mack never wear a baseball uniform? All the other managers did. You don't know the story behind that?
Or? Well, I think he didn't have the figure for a baseball uniform. You see pictures of Connie Mack
in a
uniform. He was a gaunt, tall, thin man.
Like Ike Bob Crane.
He wasn't very professional looking. They looked more like a minister or a senator or a congressman. So he was very prim. I wouldn't say prim, but very sedate. At the collar, the celluloid collar and the tie.
And the straw hat.
And of course, that was a concession they made to Mr. Mack, because he'd been in the league a long time. They let him sit on the bench with a scorecard. But one of the unusual things about Mr. Mack was he had a problem with the umpire on the field, especially the one behind home plate. His son was a coach, Earl Mack. He sent Earl Mack behind home plate and said, "Tell Mr. So-and-so I want to talk to him." Well, the umpire would come from behind home plate and come over to the dugout. And you never see that happen. You never saw it happen before. You never see it happen again, where the umpire come over to the dugout to listen to the owner, the manager of the club, because Connie was definitely a power in the American League at that time. He could create and get umpires fired if he wanted to. They came over and listened. They whisper in their ear and tell him something. They go right back to where he was going. But he got their attention.
He got their attention. Oh,
there.
That's early. Al, you came up with a Cleveland organization, but you started playing ball much later than these other men. Then you started in college.
I started 39.
No, I'm talking about age-wise. I guess some of the other fellows here started maybe much earlier, and you started.
I was 20 years old before I even knew the game of baseball existed.
Mm. So you were a fast learner.
I don't know. I needed the money.
Well,
I played 2 years of college, but we only played 12 or 13 games a year.
Well, who persuaded you to go and try it out? I mean, just someone, your
well,
dad?
Well, I was drafted by the New York Giants to play football, third round draft choice.
Oh, you were? Oh.
And I'd started up there as a track man, but I only ran 9.8, and I just wasn't quite quick enough for college. So then I hurt my knee playing football, and I just got to pivot around playing in fraternity baseball. But I feel like King Farouk, because I had a $200 no-cut contract when I started, and all the rest of those guys were making $65 and $70 a month. Of course, I was married and had two youngsters, too. I needed the money again.
So,
but our meal money was $1.25. When we were in Iowa, particularly after the short stint in first year, because I played 3.5 years in the minors. In Iowa, we'd go down to there, we'd strip off a bunch of corn, pick up some watermelons, and we'd take it in and let them cook it for us. And I was the smallest guy, six guys riding in a Chevrolet car. We used to get a kick out, we couldn't take anything to cleaner, so we'd get out of town at night, we'd just all take our pants off and fold them, put them in the back of the seat or in the back of the trunk over those old wet uniforms so it wouldn't get them wrinkled. I don't know what would happen if they were at a wreck, everybody had their pants off.
Cliff, you started out in Wilkes-Barre in the Eastern League? Is that
no, Flint, okay. Michigan.
Flint, Michigan.
1940. And we had a bunch of...
Now, you were signed up by the Cleveland Indians, too.
We had about four minor league clubs in Sumter, South Carolina. all having spring training at the same time. And I was assigned to a Class D contract for $75 a month. But I was hitting the ball good down there and doing everything about right, like a 17-year-old should. And I got a $5 a month raise, and I went to Class B. I didn't have to, I mean C, instead of going to D. That's the only league I missed in the whole thing, is the D-class.
The D-class.
Yeah.
And then who were some of the players that went up the with you on the, from one league to, all the way up through up to the majors? Were there any that went with you on that?
Not from the real low, like
well, Flint. Let's say from the Eastern League then, when you went up in East in Wilkes-Barre.
Well,
I was there with you.
Was you there that, in 43?
No, 42.
Well, I wasn't. I was in Cedar Rapids, 40. I was a year behind you each time
you
moved.
You came up because I saw you somewhere.
Well, maybe we had spring training together or something.
Because I thought you looked like a pretty good athlete.
Well, I was 42. I was in Cedar Rapids. That's where my daughter was born. And then in 43, I joined Wilkes-Barre. Then I went to service a couple of years and come back out and played in the coast and back to.
Maybe it was at Sumter, South Carolina, where I saw it.
I might have been spring training.
Because I was an outfielder down there my third year. They said, you're through pitching because I had sore arm all the time.
Yeah.
Don't be an outfielder.
Good hit.
There.
Charlie, you were in World War II.
Yes, I was.
And that's where you learned about baseball, playing with some of these guys?
Well, I played just like 2.5 months of D-ball, and I was drafted into the service in April of 43 and ended up in Sacramento in an Air Force group, and I ended up playing with Joe DiMaggio, Joe Gordon, ended up catching Red Ruffing and Johnny Beasley, playing with Ferris Fane. So I got my World War II experience. I learned a lot. Got my minor league experience. It was it was something that I know that a lot of people lost from it. Yeah. But I just happened to be a young kid. I was assigned to this, and I gained a lot of things by playing with these people. And I was very fortunate.
What kind of tips did you get from Ruffing or Lazier or this
type? Oh, goodness gracious. They taught me how to catch. Being a young kid, and more or less, they'd put down a sign, and then they'd come back and say, well, you should have done this and done that. So I learned how to make mistakes and be corrected by them. In fact, Tom Ferrick was over there in Hawaii with the Navy team that played us, the Air Force team. But I was fortunate to play with such great ball players and learned and got my minor league experience by playing against the major leaguers.
Yeah. So when you, after World War II, then you went right into...
Spring training with the Yankees, because I played with Joe Gordon. He had mentioned my name to Joe McCarthy, so I went to spring training with them, and I spent the next 3 years in AAA with the Yankee organization. And note that you had to play a little bit AAA in order to get to the big league.
Yeah.
It isn't so much that they rushed you now. Uh-huh. We had 2.5 AAA clubs. We had Kansas City, Newark, and Portland, Oregon. So they had a lot of competition.
You bet. Good baseball.
Great baseball. And being with these guys now, with the Yankees, there's something that we can't ever replace, is the camaraderie we had.
That's right.
When you walked into that club, you knew something.
We had respect because all they wanted to do was win. Allie was over there, and he'd been the forerunner, and the great pitcher, and Tom came over, and Cliff was there when I came up. But all they wanted to do was win, and they let you know it. That's the one thing, win. And just outstanding. Just being here is outstanding. Better spirit carrier. That was a pretty good one.
Now, you warmed up a lot of pitchers when you were with the Yankees out there, and in a lot of World Series, and all that richness that... with Yogi Berra and Ralph Houck, I think he was a catcher in those days.
Right.
And so you were right up there with that lineup on those fellas, too.
Yeah, I warmed a few pitchers up. Allie, Eddie Lopez, Vic Rashi, Whitey Ford.
Did Eddie Lopez ever work up a sweat when he pitched?
No, he pitched a long-sleeve sweatshirt and 110 degrees weather in Washington and never broke a sweat.
Well, what did he have that...
Waiting on more warm weather. Huh? He liked that warm weather.
What was the fastball for Eddie Lopez? 70 miles an hour?
About 70 miles an hour.
They didn't have a gun in those days.
No.
They did. I never got a job.
It would have never registered. Lopez would never register on today's gun. And they wouldn't have been signed.
If it hadn't been for the war, Eddie had never gotten to the major leagues.
He started out as a first baseman.
Oh, he did.
Yeah. Red Sox first base.
Johnny Sane played first base for 5 years in the Class D league.
Yeah, mm-hmm. They converted. Hmm. They were both pretty good hitters, but
yeah, they were good hitters.
Not they were classy pitchers. They were what they were called pitchers, not power guys like mm-hmm. Ali.
I think the outstanding thing that Lopez had was his ability to throw close to the strike zone, but never get in the
game. Yeah. Excellent control, motion, change of speed.
Well, Ted Williams just cussing. He'd rather hit anybody than Lopez.
Well, he was a master at throwing a hitter off his timing. That's what pitching is. You know, hitting is timing.
You that shoulder and that timing. Big movement.
Is this something like what you were telling earlier tonight about Stu Miller, that the double switch?
Little idiosyncrasies. They weren't easy to follow. If you get a pitcher that's easy to follow, Charlie can tell you, to follow. You're pretty hittable unless your ball is doing a lot of extra things.
Right. Yeah. Well, I was easy to swing at because I was the same all the time.
Yeah, but you were a little sudden too, though. You weren't exactly the same.
I had a couple of things.
Yeah, I guess you.
Allie never threw a straight ball, for God's sake. He tailed and jumped and curveball bounced.
And you got more than one or two. You got two or three pitches over. See, the key, these people tell you right here, they're hitters. Charlie was hitting Clippers hitter. If you get a pitcher out there that's only getting one pitch over and it's a fastball, he's in trouble.
Bad trouble.
You've got to be able to get the other stuff, otherwise you're really in trouble.
Well, I suffered for a long time before I came around.
That's right. You went through that embryo going through that thing, initiation.
Who helped you a lot on that, Allie? You said you spent 3 years laboring in the minors, and then all of a sudden it came together.
I'll tell you. They say that the older players help you. They didn't help me help. Well, I was going to take one of their jobs.
Yeah.
The only one that I ever recall was Mel Hardy. He said, son, if you learn to get that curveball over, you make it a lot easier on yourself instead of walking for a sky up every time.
Mel Hardy
was a great pitcher.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And a good pitching coach.
He was smart.
I was over at Cleveland when he was there, too. Mel was a good pitching coach,
yeah.
I think.
Mm-hmm.
Al Smith also was a lot of help to me, a left-hander. He's the one that told me, he said, when we go to Detroit and you pitch, I want you to throw sidearm to guys. Did you ever throw sidearm? I said, I don't know. What do you mean?
They showed you.
So he showed me, and it was Rudy York, and I see one right behind his head. And Rudy didn't get a hit off me for 2 years.
It wasn't the fact that he was sidearm, he was getting too close to him.
It's not my the old pitch, Yul Blackwell, that submarine pitch there.
Yeah,
that
was tough.
That was brutal.
Yeah, he was difficult.
He was rough on a left-hander.
You never imagined what it was.
No, I know.
You know, Dan, in those days, there weren't too many pitching coaches.
Oh, there were?
The minor leagues, none.
So you're a pioneer in that.
Well, you had to be a pioneer.
You personally.
Well, all of us that went through that stage, whether they were a player or a pitcher or whatever, you didn't have too many coaches. You didn't have instructors or anything else. You helped one another. I couldn't throw a curveball. When a guy in our club had a good curve and he worked with me, people would work with one another to help one another.
Mm-hmm.
When coaches weren't available, and I don't think most of us got to see coaches until we got to the big league.
Any help at all until you got to the big leagues, and some of those weren't worth shooting.
Yeah, they weren't worth
shooting. Yeah, right.
But today, it's well-structured because they have coaches at every level, batting coaches, pitching coaches, and it's important because I think they're trying to take the shortcuts to the big league today.
All they need now is a big long needle to stick in their fanny so they have a little intensity.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's where they're short.
A little want.
And with that long...
Play
long,
hungry.
Right. With the long contract,
yeah.
They keep a low profile. They need a lot of one-hop outfielders.
A lot of one-hop outfielders?
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Well, they don't go get the ball. They just play it on,
play it on the hop.
It doesn't hurt them that way.
Yeah, it don't hurt. Sting your hand.
Yeah.
If there's one word that you can use today that they had years ago, they don't use it today. I'd say years ago there was an urgency among the players to get to the next level because I know you all had managers in the minor league said, well, if you don't like this league, bust your ass and get out of here, because that's where you had to make money as you went up the line. And there was an urgency. If you didn't play baseball, you had to go back to a factory. Most of us did. Mm-hmm. Allie was fortunate, had a little bit, a few years in college, he might have found something better to do.
Yeah.
But the average guy playing professional baseball, if he failed in baseball, he had to go back to driving a truck, you know, and to find some other way of life. And the urgency was there to excel and put out, so that's what created the tendency. Today, the urgency isn't there because you got 2-3 year contracts. Guys sitting on a bench and making $300,000, you get in a big league for 5 years, and with that kind of money, why the hell's the urgency? Mm-hmm. We had to go get a job in the winter. I coached and played in the big leagues. Every winter I come home, I had to go get another job to supplement the little bit I made to raise a family. It's not there today, Dan.
Yeah. I 1947 American Association yearbook. You may have a copy of that, Charlie, but I sent a Xerox copy to Cliff a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. And you're right, Tom. I would look at off-season occupation. Joe Muffalo, steel worker in Gary, Indiana.
Yeah.
Somebody else, driving truck.
It was a rarity if a guy didn't work there.
I thought everybody did.
I sold clothes, whatever we did. I worked the railway express.
But you couldn't spend a few bucks you made in the summer because it'd be all. And when you went to spring training, you went with Zilch. You didn't get no Murphy money, no mill money. Mm-hmm. You didn't get paid till the 15th of April.
You had to take money out of your pocket.
Yeah, stretch money that for now.
You didn't get paid until the 15th of April.
Right, paid until the 15th.
I'll never forget when they first gave us $25 a week for drag.
1947, right?
What an innovation.
Deluxe.
$25 is a lot of money in those days. But today, they get Murphy money. They get $500 or $600 a week for room and board and meals when they live out of a hotel.
Yeah.
Murphy money for tips, Murphy money for this.
I think baseball could do itself a favor by restructuring their economic schedules.
Situation.
They're too much
at the
on
top.
The top. Hmm. There's too big a jump from AAA to the majors.
Yeah.
And they go up in a hurry.
They're still playing for peanuts and minors.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's still a lot of that.
They're going to lose their people to train them because they don't pay them.
Can't pay them a living wage. Yep.
It's unfortunate that the guys that get the top should have the most money, but not all of it. Yeah. That's what's happening. It's way out of
balance.
The pension for major league players went into effect about 1948, 49.
47, exactly.
47 was it started.
How'd you get into it? I guess you had to put some money up front. And
well,
that's a big kind of money.
$250?
$250 in escrow, 46, and put it in the bank. And if you were in a major league roster in 1947, you qualified. Even though you put your money in 46 up $250, you had to be on a roster in 1947 to qualify. And then they progressive premiums. Like if you're a first year guy, you paid $44, and the clubs matched the premium you played paid.
Mm-hmm.
If you had previous service, like I did in 47,
military service.
A military counted.
Uh-huh.
41, 42, 3 in the service gave me 5. 46 was 6, and 47, I was going into my 7th year. So my premiums came to about $250 a month, and then the club matched it, but that was the only revenue that thing had.
Yeah.
And the owners had a clause in that pension plan that they started. They could have eliminated that pension plan at any time with just them say so.
In 1951, I was elected American League representative. First, I was a representative of the Yankee Ball Club, then I was American League representative, and I worked on that pension fund. And we got together and got us an attorney, and I got a call to come up Mr. Webb's office. He said, "What the hell are you doing? Are you trying to form a union?" I said, "No, I'm not interested in a union." He said, "What are you trying to do?" I said, "All we're trying to do is something that you guys will be smart enough to do.
Mm-hmm.
You're putting that money into the central fund and lets the commissioner get his arm in it down to the elbow, then it's thrown into all the tax pictures of the ball clubs." And I said, "When he got back, you know what we had this year? $180,000. That ain't going to be make a pension
fund." Not going to keep it on the ground.
He said, "What do you want to do?" I said, "Put it into a pension fund so there's no taxes. It should not even enter a tax picture." And they started doing that, and then in a couple of years, we had a meeting and got it divided up. What was attributed to the pension fund was split. 60% for the owners, 40% for the players. And that's the reason I sued baseball a couple of years later when Miller was trading it off for money. I thought that ownership denoted a lot more, and I'd still say that if they had ownership going right now, we wouldn't have all these strikes and all these problems going on, because they'd had some basis to work with. So the way it is, both sides want the whole damn thing.
Mm.
That's bad.
Well, you know, Allie, I remember...
The greatest thing that's ever happened to a professional sport is a pension fund.
I remember in 1950, I was my 1 year with the Yankees. You might recall this. You were there too, Charlie. We're getting ready to play the Phillies, and I think Tommy Hendrick and maybe Jerry Coleman were his representatives at that time. And we had a meeting after we clinched the series, and we heard rumbling that the Phillies were not going to play the World Series unless they found out where the money was going to go for the radio and television. It was one of the first contracts, $1.5 million, radio and television. So we told Coleman, the players voted to tell Coleman and Henry to go to Hank Chandler. to find out what the distribution of that money was going to be, he come back and said, the owners have realized there's something going on here. They're going to give you 40%, they're going to get 60%. So we've all voted to put that 40% into the pension fund. We forfeited any right to put that in the World Series pot. We didn't have to put that in a pot. The Yankees and the Phillies could have split that money.
Mm-hmm.
But we forfeited our rights for that money to put it in the pension plan, and that kept it afloat, and it got it off the ground a little bit. But that was only $100 a month for 10 years in the big leagues. And then later on down the road, when they started playing the two All-Star games, they were $13 million in debt because they were bringing guys from $100 who were collecting to $250. Allie will probably remember that. And it cost us $13 million in back service to make up that loss. And that's how they did it with the two All-Star games.
But the
players in those days, Dan, made a lot of sacrifices to get the pension plan off the ground. And today, it's not recognized. That's the sad part of this thing.
And there was nothing retroactive in the meetings. I still have the meetings from 1947 I opened with the Yankees. Everybody was happy to get their the pension going. But there was no such thing as being retroactive, and that's where we lost out.
I was American League representative through 54, and in 56 I was terminated from the thing. I couldn't get any more money from it. And that's not really kosher.
Now, has that changed a little bit? I heard that a couple of weeks ago that they tried...
Yet.
Well, what they did, they went back in classifications and brought people up to date, but I think they're being... let's say maybe not forced, but the IRS is looking over their shoulders about how much they've accumulated in the funds from the radio and television, and I don't know what the rules and regulations are on pensions, but the IRS is beginning to frown on a surplus and nothing was done with it. So they finally decided one of the better ways to do it was to go back and pick up the older guys and bring them to another level.
Start spending it.
They're either going to have to disperse that money or they're going to have to pay taxes.
Right. The government's
one of the two things.
And it's amazing how much they've got in there.
Unbelievable.
Charlie, you saw a lot of ball players in come and go, and earlier this evening I think you were talking about Satchel Paige. Did you bring up the story about him and not only the rocking chair but his
The
movement and his story that said don't bunt on me?
Oh yeah, well Satchel, I didn't, you know, I never hit against Satchel, but I saw him pitch a few times and he was at the end of his career, but he was something else again because one day in St. Louis, I guess Allie was pitching the game, and Allie could probably elaborate more on it, what happened on that day, because it was a hot day in St. Louis, humid, and Allie, you picked up the story.
That was the old Sportsman Park. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's when I did something that I've never been sure was kosher. We had gone, you guys said 5 or 6, I thought it was 7.
Yeah, but...
And we didn't have a hit off Satchel Paige, and he'd lean over out there, and I'd watch him, and that sweat would drip off the tip of his cap like that, just steady. And I'd just about to die in there with all this cool stuff on me. So he came up to hit in the first of the eighth inning, and I walked the son of a gun, put him on first base, and then instead I turned it set up. That's what you're out there for, is to win.
Yeah, try to find some way to get him calm.
Now, did you call that decision yourself, Allie?
I threw the balls.
Okay, well, that's right. That's
and it was no doubt about what I was doing because I only threw 4.
You didn't usually throw 4 in a row.
So you let him sit out there and sweat a little bit there while...
I'll tell you something I did. I wouldn't have done it any in the situation. I was in Washington in 48 or so, and Al Evans was the catcher on the Washington Ball Club. We're playing near the end of the season. We weren't going. We were out of the race. And the Red Sox were out of the race. I think it was 49 or 47. And Ted Williams came to the plate late in the game. We were winning by about 6-4 or 6-3, which was not common in Washington playing the Red Sox. 2 out in the ninth. And Williams is coming up. So I got a brainstorm. I call out Al Evans too. And I said, Al, I said, let's see how far this big guy can hit one. We're playing at Griffith Stadium. So he said, what are you talking about? I said, you go back and tell him I'm going to lay one right down the pipe. Let's see how far he can hit it. He said, you must be crazy. I said, no, we got a 3-run. I think I can get the other two, get one guy out more. Okay, he goes back and he puts it down. And I see William step out of the box and look at him like there's something going on. I know what it was. He didn't believe that. So he looked out at me and I shook my head to let him know, it's going to happen. See, so I laid that ball right down knee high and he hit that sucker. And Buddy Lewis was playing right field. See, that fence in right field, the Griffith Stadium, was quite a piece. He hit that goddamn ball so hard he got topspin on it, see? It looked like it was going for the monument when it started out, but he had that spin and was bringing it back. Lewis runs back up against the fence and catches up against the wall for the third out. He didn't get under it. But Evans thought I was cuckoo. The first time I had a lead like that and be able to do it, pitch the winnings like that. But he really cold cocked that sucker.
Well, I tell you, I think that he was a low ball hitter.
Yeah.
But I'd rather pitch him low because he'd hit those top spins and then he'd go out of the ballpark.
They'd sink.
Yeah.
You couldn't fool him.
No way you could fool him.
Great eye.
Now,
Chris, I got to tell one Terry Williams story.
Okay.
With Bill McGowan was number one, they called the umpire. I happened to be catching one day in Boston. And, Ted always take the close pitch. So I just didn't dare turn around to McGowan.
I
said, Bill, I said, geez, I think that was strike three. And he says, throw the ball back, you bush. Beep, beep. They came to see him hit, not you catch.
Well, he could really handle it.
Bill McGowan.
Bill McGowan should be in the Hall of Fame.
He was good.
Greatest, you know, DiMaggio. I was talking to DiMaggio today. He said Bill McGowan was the best umpire in America like the years he played. That's a pretty good accolade.
You did. Coming from Joe.
The best game I recall was in a series and they just put him in the Hall of Fame.
Barley. Yeah.
He called the game.
He's a good umpire.
Yeah.
The best ball and strike that I'd had at that time, and I walked up, don't believe you. He looked at me like it was crazy.
Out of your mind, huh? But he was good because Barlick umpired in Piedmont League in 37. He was a great umpire then as a young umpire. But you know, I'll tell you a funny story about McGowan. It involved Ray Scarborough, as most of these fellows know here. He's what they call an RA, you know, to find out any way you want, red A, you know.
Yeah.
And he got upset a lot. He was pitching one night in Washington, McGowan behind the plate. And I'm on the Washington ball club down in the bullpen watching this game, and Ray is going, it's a hot night. McGowan's behind the plate, and Ray is not satisfied with some of the calls that he's making. He's showing it. He's very miserable, but he was unhappy.
It was getting worse.
And finally, McGowan got a little disturbed about it. He said, here, he took the indicator and threw it out to the mound, see? So Scarborough goes and gets the indicator and puts it in his pocket. Then he goes back to the mound, see? And Bill was back then. He suddenly realized what the hell he's doing. He can't operate without an indicator. He said, bring that thing in here. He said, you come and get it. This little dialogue going on between the two. He said, bring that indicator in. He said, you come out and get it. And he wouldn't come out, see? And that thing went on and on. And McGowan had umpired the game without the indicator. Scarborough kept it in his pocket. He got the upper hand. I was there to see that. It was unbelievable. And Ray was hot, and McGowan got hotter. So some of those things stick in your mind, Dan. That's what makes it. Some of those things are unbelievable.
I know we could go on and on for hours, but Cliff,
I've been up since 5:30. No, 4:30 this morning. Well, I better go.
Okay, but I'd like for you to tell the one story where you hit that ball out of the old Kansas City Blues ballpark that you told at the dinner table. I think the first one that was ever hit out of the ballpark.
Oh, no, there's been quite a few hits.
Well, I meant in 1947, but you said you didn't get a good swing on it, even though it went 550 feet.
But it didn't really feel good.
It didn't feel good.
You might have hit that much into it, you did.
Yeah. I think it wouldn't help.
Is that the first AML flight?
Yeah. No, but they had been a lot of them hit over the double fence, but the plate was out a little closer.
Uh-huh.
They moved it back.
Yeah, moved it
40. Yeah. Well, the winner 46. They're making it.
That was a giant home run. Huh?
It just felt like it didn't hit.
Even though it went 550 feet.
So Roy like Woodley would say it was three axle grease into the movie.
Well,
we saw some guys hit ball. I think Allie might have to agree. In 51, I was in spring training with the Yankees, probably Cliff and Allie were both there when Mickey Mantle came to the big leagues.
Oh, shoot.
And he was a young rookie. And we made a trip around the West Coast playing some of the Pacific Coast League teams. And we had to be amazed, too, as long as Allie and I and Cliff have been around the game, to see some of the balls that he hit over light towers in those Pacific League parks. Right-handed and left-handed. And they say, this guy hit one there, and Mickey did it further. I think he was 18, 19 years old.
Yeah.
When he came out.
Unbelievable.
He hit one over the top in Forbes Field.
That's right.
And it was a tremendous drive. Slow curve.
Mm.
The pitcher threw a slow curve, and Mickey took a swat at it and missed it. And Lopez said, I'd like to see him try that one more time, and damn if he didn't, and it was gone.
It was just a muscle, it was just a strength. You know, they say Hank Aaron had tremendous wrist action.
He didn't have the power that Manley had. You didn't put him in the same category.
500 feet, 450, 500, he hit that. The ball he hit down to Washington, I guess, was way out of sight.
That went over the top of that signboard on the back of the bleachers, and I never seen one hit over the bleachers.
That was a ridiculous.
They took it over 600 feet on that one.
He had them in Tiger Stadium over that roof too, in right field.
Okay. We was playing after I got away from the Yankees. We was playing one night at the Yankees at Detroit. He come up right-handed, and he hit one in right center field, and hit that press box up there, that wooden press box that goes all the way up. And that ball bounced pert near back to second base.
Ricochet then?
No, just bounced right straight back. He hit the right field, right-handed, and hit that right field hill and hit solid wood and bounced almost back to second. It took no time at all for that ball to get out of that ballpark.
I know, I think.
Reminds me of the one that Greenberg hit off of Spud Chandler. He hit it and it went right like that, and he made a grab at it and it went to center field stands. He came in and said, damn, I'm glad I didn't hook onto this.
Well, fellas, I know it's late in the evening and you've been a lot of traveling. You've got a busy day tomorrow. And what I'll do is make a copy and send this to you at your home. And the master will go up to Bill Guilfoyle, the Baseball Hall of Fame, in the Oral History Archives. And I know we could spend probably 50 more hours of great stories.
Well,
and so I want to thank you for doing that in this late evening.